commission, who's going to deal with that?
Basically, on each subject, Michael, myself, we're going to provide some introductory words, and then the conversation and the discussion can go on with everyone getting involved. Prior to getting into revenue recognition per se, I think we wanted to clearly acknowledge and commend the board for having extended the completion schedule for the standards, and also to have decided on issuing prior to final publication some form of, I don't know whether it's staff draft or new final draft, provided that no exposure is needed. So we really very much welcome that. That said, we would recommend also on this that the ISB in a way commits to leaving a certain amount of time for people to consider the near final draft, I mean standards, and so that it really serves the purpose of having people evaluate whether they can understand and implement the final requirements. When discussing with more particularly national standard setters in Europe, the advice that has been formulated is that they would have, constituents would have 3 months to really look into the federal requirements. The other advice that has been given is that when that is done, that all documents would be available, so you don't publish only the standard, but also the illustrative examples and the basis for conclusions, because it is with the sum of all these documents that this assessment can be made. Some also believe that the effect study report should be available, but some people do think that. So on also what we intended to say on this subject is that we would recommend that step in the consultation process of the ISB, to in the due process of the ISB, to become an ordinary feature when significant changes are to be brought by a particular standard. We also, on the longer term, but also for these standards, once they are finalized after that step, we recommend that the effect study reports would be available on publication of the standards, not at a later date, because they're we don't know exactly what they say, but we expect that they're a very interesting analysis, and we would like to rely on it, no more particularly in our work as part of the endorsement process in Europe. Would you like to have some comments on this?
Yes. We had a meeting yesterday about the near final standard, or whatever it is we're going to call it, which was one of the topics of the meeting, because it is a new process, and so we're kind of feeling our way a bit. We also want to manage expectations, because we don't want it to become a full exposure draft. Again, that's not the intention. So how you walk that line is a little bit tricky. I don't know, Alan, if you'd like to comment on some of the things we talked about.
Yeah, a couple of things for clarification. The boards have always considered that the basis and any related material has to go out. We questioned whether or not we need all the consequential amendments. My view is that at least two types of consequential amendment you might want to consider. The mechanical updating, where you change a reference and change the terminology, we don't think the review process is designed to pick that up. But clearly, if you have a consequential amendment that has a change in the accounting requirements, that ought to be part of that package as well. It's a bit tricky to separate those things out, but Essentially, we want to make sure that, that people are reviewing the right words. But certainly the basis and any mandatory material. Illustrative examples, if they're not mandatory, they're education, probably not, because we don't know when we produce those anyway. But anything that would be part of the core standards, so that's the, you know, the for if you follow our new model now with IFRS's 10, 11 and 12, that's the main part, plus Appendix A, which is defined terms, and B, which is the application guidance, and C, which are transition. And effective dates. So essentially everything that would be you would normally endorse, and then the basis would go with that as well. The main thing we want to do is, you know, is to as Ian has alluded to, is making sure we manage expectations, and it's what we to put, I guess this might sound a bit defensive, but we don't want to be accused of actually using this as a proxy for or a substitute for re-exposure, because we're not going to be asking those questions. The questions we're going to be asking are around whether or not the work we've actually captured the technical decisions in an appropriate manner, and it is operational. So it is more of a drafting review, and so quite seriously, we've had a bit of angst over what we call this thing. You know, fatal flaw sounds a bit of a problem. We don't want to really want to put something out that's potentially fatally flawed. So we're probably going to talk about a drafting review or a review draft, and leave it at that. It would also be owned by the board as opposed to the staff, so we wouldn't call it a staff draft, and that means we have some internal processes to go through to make sure that both boards are comfortable in us releasing the document. The other thing too, we talked about, and again, this is partly about managing expectations and not setting it what we would call a comment period date, saying it's open for 60 days. What we'll be signalling, what our intention is to do, is to signal when we expect to discuss the issues again, so that people have a good understanding that, you know, perhaps if we have a draft out in July and the staff are expecting to consider any feedback they receive in the October meeting, then people have got a clear signal that that's what we're aiming for. But we don't want to give a sense that this is a very formal process with a 60-day cut-off and this is where the letters go to and so on. And we're hoping it'll be quite a formal and frank exchange with people, because the tougher people are on our drafting, the better the quality of the products. And that comes up with a dilemma. If normally with comment letters, this will be a very public process, but we want people to be quite brutal, to be honest, to make sure that we get the drafting right. In most cases, as we do with fatal flaws now, when we do have firms and other organisations involved, the comments we receive are not official comments of the firms. They don't go through their internal processes and getting sign-off it through their particular hierarchies. They tend to be feedback from experts within the organisations. The people we're actually going to be working with on a day-to-day basis, the ones who are signing off, you know, the technical reviews and so on, but they're not the official review views of the organisation, and I think that's probably our preference, is to keep it at that level, because that's actually more helpful for us.
It's going to be quite difficult to manage the process and the expectations, because it's new, and you know, we're still feeling our way basically on how it'll all work. No, Jerome? Isabel?
I'm hearing 60 days in July, and I think we might have a problem with that, because, as you know, a lot of constituents are on holiday, meaning that in effect you're giving 30 days, if that's what you're talking about.
Ian, people had the expectation. It was something different from what was just explained by Alan, exactly in your own words, I suspect. And, of course, to introduce a new product in the middle or at the end of a process that's very sensitive is something very extraordinary that I have difficulties really explaining at home. So if you add this difficulty on top, maybe the expectations are already out of control, and I understand you want to manage them. What do you want to do?
Well, I mean, if you don't like the process, I mean, I guess we could not go ahead with it. That's one step. But we're trying to be helpful to the constituents. We're trying to walk a road. This will apply if we don't think there should be a re-exposure. So this is not an automatic replacement of re-exposure. So the re-exposure considerations are exactly the same as they've always been. They haven't changed. However, if the boards decide we do not need to re-expose, then this is an opportunity for the constituents. A lot of the comments we hear is we'd like to see the thing as a whole. And I think that's reasonable. And this is an attempt to show the market, the constituents, the document as a whole, and to give them a chance to comment on that. But it isn't a re-exposure. If a re-exposure is needed, there'll be a formal and proper re-exposure in the normal course of events.
Yeah, I guess that's what people
try. Yeah.
The need for re-exposure.
Yeah.
The draft as opposed to it. That's
sure. Roger.
I personally welcome this. I mean, no matter what it's called, but I do echo Isabel's thoughts. I think part of the advantage of this is people can actually try it out to make sure it is operationalizable. That's the word. And I think if they don't get enough time to do that over the holiday season, it's not necessarily going to work. So I would encourage you this occasion, given we're going through the summer, to make sure people do have enough time to actually try it out and make sure that in their various industries they can actually operationalize it.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, we'll take that point on board. Any other comments? Please, Saul.
Alan somehow did not mention something which Francoise asked for. When are the effect studies coming, or feedback statements, or whatever you call them? Because you said something about the core package, and my understanding of what you said is that you don't think that's part of the core package.
No. My personal view is I wouldn't expect the feedback statements or the effect analysis would be part of that core package, should know. A lot of the analysis and the basis for conclusions is replicated in the effect analysis anyway, so you'll get most of that. I don't expect us to get that package out as well. And you'll have seen from our experience already with JVs and consoles, it can take a lot longer to finalise things than we anticipate sometimes. And we prefer to put the effort to make sure that they are out at the same time that we're concluding the projects rather than after.
Also, it's quite hard to do an effect study until you've got the absolute final.
In fact, if I could add, the part of this process in terms of how well can you work with us and operationalise it, I suspect that it'll give us the opportunity to talk with a few people and create some case studies for how they see this affecting them in terms of their ability, what sort of system changes they'll need to make. Be far more able to make those judgments having seen a draft than us going in today to ask them that question without having seen a draft. So I think it'll actually inform our effect analysis more than anything else.
Francoise.
Yes, before we get into revenue recognition, that I think we should do. I think you heard our recommendation on this in terms of timing and having the available package of documents. We would expect that we are coordinating as we usually do for that period and organize in coordination with you some field testing on focused areas where we believe that is necessary. If I take the advantage of having the floor and getting into revenue recognition,
sure.
Highlight as a first point that really in the events that were organized, most participants were not yet convinced really that the change in the revenue recognition standards were needed. That we need to point out. It's fully reflected in the feedback statement that has been communicated now. That said, when they contemplate the re-deliberations that the board have gone through, they acknowledge that a lot of the concerns that the proposals that created have been appropriately dealt with. Nevertheless, there remain, I would say, two main concerns. One has to do with the guidance on when continuous transfer of benefits occurs. There is the concern that revenue can be recognized without a right to payment being acquired by the entity. And we have provided you with a paper that outlines a possible change from where you are in the guidance, which is not a complete rewrite. It's more something like an adjustment than it is a rewrite, and that we would be happy to discuss with you. The second set of concern has to do with some industries that still have difficulties with the model. And EFRAG's view on this is really that we've been supportive since the beginning of the attempts that the board was taking of having one principle for all. But it is in solving the remaining issues for some industries that the board will really demonstrate that one principle for all is feasible. So we would highly recommend that the board does its utmost to solve the remaining concerns, more particularly in the telecommunication and software industries. Without obviously creating problem for others that happen. In addition to this, and not necessary for discussion, I think we would like to highlight three other points in terms of the decisions made by the board in relation to the accounting for the time value of money in revenue recognition. The various deliberations of the board have been very welcomed by the constituents. It's more EFRAG recommendation that now that a guidance has been set for identifying a significant component, financing component in a transaction, whether you really need to have the short-term exemption, because it might be not necessarily relevant in some circumstances, some areas. We do not have the concern in Europe at present, but we can see that it could be the case. We also would like to mention that some constituents in the events had a problem in terms of dealing with credit risk, in having potentially incurred losses and revisions of expected losses to be presented immediately after the revenue line, because this would affect a gross margin indicator. And basically, what we heard from constituents is, why don't you leave the geography in the income statement to the choice of the entities after having made the requirement that if there are expected losses upon initial recognition, they would be presented as a deduction from the revenue line. So also we would wish to recommend that if you go, which is another possibility for some partial re-exposure and not a full re-exposure on revenue recognition, then you would do so in the context of making the full set of documents again available that people can see where the changes that you consult on sit in. And finally, I would like also to stress that you must be aware that in the various locations where we've been, a majority of constituents have a great expectations that there would be full exposure on the basis that a lot of changes have been made from the proposals.
Okay. Now, you've got a number of things here. the guidance, the point on some of the industries, the short-term exemption, and then where you put the credit risk, the loss, the immediate loss. You talked about partial re-exposure, and I just missed your point there. I'm sorry. Oh, hang on.
We've been discussing that, you know, if you decide to go for the partial exposure, for example, you say we just consult, want some input on how we change the guidance to contingent transfer, or you make some amendments to the disaggregation guidance that you have one particular point that you decide to address. You shouldn't go with just exposing the draft changes only, but you would expose the full pre-final standard so that people can see how the interrelationship between the proposal that you're making and the final decision that you've made.
Okay.
And again, with basis for conclusions and illustrative examples, because it's the full, even if only one part of it is endorsed in the end, it's the full a set of documents which is helpful to understand and assess.
Okay.
And one point that I should have mentioned is the point on disclosures. We have heard also a lot of concerns, but that's in a way a pervasive issue on the various standards that are being prepared. On revenue recognition is even more critical because some people fear that the benefit that they have had with IFRS 8 would be lost.
So they're worried about too much disclosure or not enough?
Too much disclosures being too prescriptive.
Too restrictive?
Too prescriptive.
Prescriptive.
No, not too restrictive. That's not the concern.
I mean, all of these standards we're looking at, we're piling disclosures on disclosures, and that's a worry to me. But, Henry, have you got all that? Can you push your button?
Revenue recognition criteria, first of all. I guess perhaps it's just worth me highlighting, first of all, that the reason why we've structured it the way that we did, and therefore I think perhaps the key point being that we have the right to payment, if you like, as a sub-criterion rather than a sort of major criterion as it is in your sort of suggested alternative. It is because we were trying to frame this in terms of our principle, which is you recognise revenue when goods or services are transferred to the customer and the control. And so I guess we felt with, if you look at 2B, 1 and 2, in those situations what we're sort of saying is that if the customer's receiving a benefit or if the entity wouldn't need to re-perform, then goods and services are transferring to the customer. And so in terms of the core revenue recognition principle, then that is met. But what I would just highlight is there are other parts of the model that all come into play here as well, which first of all is, of course, you have to have a contract, and the contract contains a right to consideration. And then secondly, even if you're in the continuous transfer model, which I think actually we need to change that label because it's not necessarily continuous revenue recognition, that there are two things. You still need to sort of measure your progress under that contract, and you need to measure the revenue. So you could have a situation whereby, yes, the customer is receiving services, and I think you have this example actually in your outreach materials, or I've certainly discussed it with Rasmus. And essentially, yes, at the end of the month, the customer can sort of say, you didn't meet some sort of... the customer had the right effectively to sort of say, I'm going to cancel for the last month and, you know, not pay or get a refund. And in that situation, I mean, you still have to consider that possibility when you're measuring the revenue. So, you know, I think I just wanted to highlight that, you know, there are other bits of the model that you need to think about in terms of not just the criteria that you've got in sort of paragraph two of the memo. The other bit was is that we have got this right to payments, right to payment for performance to date in our criteria, and we've used that in this situation where it's sort of where it's difficult to actually really figure out whether the transfer is taking place. And I think the board's sort of conclusion was is that essentially if you're creating something that really has this no alternative use, and I'll come back to that in a moment, and the customer's obliged to pay for everything that's been done to date, then in essence that was enough to sort of say that the customer is taking control as that asset is being produced. So, I mean, that's just why we structured it the way that we did. I think the other one of the other key points you raise is about no alternative use. And I think with hindsight, I wish that we'd put some more words around this in our update report and that we had on the website, because I don't think we mean it quite as literally as some have read it. And in actual fact, in looking at your sort of proposed alternative criteria, I think we've actually picked up some of the words that you've got here in the explanation around it. So the idea that you've got about the goods being produced are not ordinarily interchangeable, I mean, I think we've got some language similar to that. So it's we are sort of saying, yes, you could be producing something. The customer walks away from that contract. If you would have to do sort of rework to it to transfer it to another customer, but you could do that, then that still has no alternative use. So it is coming back to this idea of it's just an inventory item, and essentially, you know, you could just transfer it or direct it to another customer without significant rework. So judgment will be required, I think, particularly in the software example, which, you know, we've discussed with some of the European software players. But I think with more words around it, hopefully the criterion will make a little bit more sense. But it did just strike me that the words that you had here in your alternative criterion, I think we're pretty similar to that, actually.
Mike, do you want to comment?
I just wanted to comment briefly on the alternative use, because the more I reflect on this, I don't think we're that far away, but I do think it's more than just whether or not it requires significant rework. I think it really also incorporates the concept of whether or not the supplier, if you like, has the ability to determine alternative use. So if I take the example of I'm constructing a house for somebody, it's on a specific plot, so clearly it's for that customer. I can't just take it and sell it to somebody else.
Yep.
But if that customer walks away from that contract, I probably can sell it without significant rework.
Yep.
So I think there's something around the notion that it's not just at the behest of the supplier to change his mind about, if you like, which contract he's supplying this piece of material for. And so I want to somehow get that in there as well as the rework.
And Mike, I think that's a very good point. And I think we have got it in there because we talk about something that essentially you couldn't transfer it to another customer without breaching that contract. So we were thinking about some of the real estate examples, particularly contracts. I mean, the example was some of the Asian real estate contracts. And essentially, because you've sold a specific apartment or a specific, you know, plot of land or whatever, then essentially, yes, it does have no alternative use without significant rework, as you sort of say, but you couldn't transfer it to another customer without breaching that contract, and I think we've embedded that notion in there as well.
Francois.
Yeah, I'm happy with the explanations. That said, I would might just comment it on the alternative use issue. I would like to go back on the right to payment issue. If you, when you finalize the standard, in fact, when you combine having a contract with, I suppose, the reasonable assurance criterion that you have for uncertain consideration, if that ends up making the right to consideration to date a condition for revenue recognition, I guess we would be fully happy with that. It would completely meet the concern expressed here. That said, if that's the case, I don't really understand why you need to have that supplementary possible criterion in your guidance, because the guidance written with that possibility suggests that it's not a condition in every circumstance.
Well, I think it is slightly different from what you're saying. I mean, I guess I was just trying to sort of highlight that, you know, that there has to be a contract here and you have to think about measuring the revenue. I mean, what we meant by that criterion, the entity has a right to payment for performance to date, is really encapsulating that notion that the customer's obliged to pay in full for what's been done to date. So for example, I mean, if I, you know, had sold something to Pat here, and essentially if she, and I was building it under contract, so I build to order, and then sort of Pat terminates that contract, but I could sell it, you know, to Warren, but he demands a discount because he doesn't get exactly the spec that he wants. That's not payment in, that's not what we mean by the right to payment for performance to date, and so that's what we were specifically trying to capture there. And so we're linking it with the idea of I'm building something that has no alternative use for Pat, and she's obliged to pay for what I've done today, you know, subject to the fact that I will continue to perform under that contract. And I guess, Francoise, it's, you know, we'll certainly think on the comments that you're raising here, but I guess one of the things we're very anxious to do, and this has come up in meetings that we've had, is that these additional criteria that we put in 2B to try and make the sort of the transfer model more capable of consistent application for service contracts, which is what we got that feedback on, we still want to be very clear of how it relates to the basic principle of transfer of goods and services. And, you know, we've got to explain that very clearly about why it's not a different model and how it all ties back. And I guess my personal concern is if you sort of put the right to consideration at the top, you're in danger of, to my mind, of it flipping to a right to consideration model as being your core recognition principle.
If I just get Philippe and then Mike. And then
I understand that both the flag and what you say, Henry, but it's a question of geography. And is geography and comparing. We have two different set of criteria. If you look at the table in paragraph 6, we say the entity has to fulfill at least one of the following two criteria. And in one, we don't mention explicitly the right to payment, and we do mention right to payment in the second criteria. So by comparison between the two, some people might think that the right to payment is not important if you are in the first criteria, whereas it is important if you are in the second criteria. And so I think this is at least worth considering how people will interpret that by comparison between the two situations.
Mike?
I was slightly confused by the sort of second set of comments you made compared to the first set of comments you made, because at one stage I thought when you were initially speaking, you were regarding right to payment as a measurement rather than a recognition issue. And I think we see it as a recognition issue. And I wasn't quite sure from your second set of statements whether it might be a sub-criteria, whether it is a recognition issue or whether we flip back to measurement.
I think it is being used as a recognition criterion in those cases where it's not immediately obvious that goods and services are transferring to the customer, in the sense of it's not obvious that the customer is receiving a benefit as in a basic service contract, or it's not immediately obvious that the performance obligation is being satisfied continuously, in the sense that another party sort of stepping into the supplier's shoes would sort of pick up where from the point of where you are in the contract. So we have used it there as a sort of like the combination of two criteria to sort of say yes, in that situation, no alternative use, and the customer's obliged to pay for payment, that in effect control of goods and services is transferring.
Peter?
Yeah, one more comment on the alternative use. I suspect in practice that would be a criterion that's very prone to lots of interpretation, because everything has an alternative use. I mean, you can use your books at a doorstop. That doesn't necessarily mean that that's the way to interpret the criterion. So I wonder whether is wise to use something like alternative use, which means different things to everybody in this room, and something like, is it an item of inventory or a test akin to that?
I mean, it
makes more sense to me intuitively.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very good point about thinking whether, as an expression, if it's going to require, you know, I mean, we'll obviously put more words around it, but if it doesn't sort of immediately speak to you, maybe it's not the best set of words, and we'll certainly think about that as we draft.
I suspect it will require a lot of maintenance over the life of the standard.
Okay, Henry?
Yes.
Stephen?
This right to payment, I'm sort of confused by it a bit. Are you saying that it's a right to payment without any conditions, or is it a right to payment assuming that you will continue and complete the contract? So I'm halfway through an audit, and the auditor's put in jail and can't finish the audit. Is there a right to payment? Is it that the contract says it hasn't been completed, but you still get payment for the work done, or is the right to payment assuming that there will be completion? Because if it's the latter, then we've already got that, surely, because of what Henry said, that it's that there's a contract, and within the contract there's a right to payment. So I'm confused.
Yeah, France was.
I guess the easiest way to illustrate the type of circumstances which are worrisome is that to build on Henry's example, when he has sold something to Pierre, and the contract says that there is a down payment of, let's say, 20% of the total consideration, so that has been paid. If Pat walks away, she loses the down payment, but she doesn't have any other obligation. And your draft guidance, as we understand it, the entity can recognize up to how much revenue, up to where the construction has progressed when Pat declares that she walks away. And so there is a contract, but that contract says that Pat can walk away. It triggers a loss for her of the down payment, but nevertheless, the entity can have recognized up to 80% of the consideration as revenue just because it has made progress under that contract. And so to respond to your question of, yes, it is a right to payment on the assumption that the entity is not in default. So it is without default.
So you're concerned about the customer walking away?
Some contracts can give the customer the right to walk away under certain conditions, and that condition may be just the loss of a down payment or even nothing. So it's not enough to say that there is a contract. Either you define what a contract means. More precisely, it's not any contract, or and I guess it would probably be easier that way, you make that a necessary condition prior to...
So what about a sale with right to return? Maybe we're going too far now.
Well, I think you need to bear in mind, Francois, that we're talking about contracts that are enforceable. Normally when you have enforceable contracts, there's some compensation payable if you walk away. You break the contract, basically. That happens in real life, sure, but we are talking about enforceable contracts in this project.
Mike?
I think it's enforceable, but as Francois...
You're not on, Mike.
I think it's enforceable, but as Francois says, that enforceability may not be specific performance. It may be you lose your deposit.
Yep.
Well, and that's your compensation.
Sure.
So the concern we would have, and construction contracts are a good one to use as an illustration. If somebody is constructing a specific house for somebody, it is very clear that it meets most of your criteria. If that customer has the contractual ability, not, if you like, breaking the contract, but simply, if I decide not to go through with this, the consequence is I lose my deposit. In our view, it is not appropriate to recognise revenue over and above that level, because until he has accepted the house, that's where you're limited to.
Okay, well, let me...
Under the way the criteria would work here, you wouldn't recognise revenue. You wouldn't be in the continuous transfer model in that example.
Well, you're constructing a building. Most of the time you'd be in a continuous transfer model.
I thought you sort of said that the customer was not obliged to pay for performance today. In your example, Mike.
If you're looking at transfer of control, Henry's saying the first...
So you're saying that because they're not obliged to pay for the performance to date, that means you have not got... And I suppose the other question then is, do you recognise revenue up to the level of the deposit? Because to that extent, they are required to. Or, because that's one of the other concerns we had, is when you talk about they're required to pay for performance to date, does that mean there has to be a pound-to-pound correlation between that in order to fit that criteria, or does that act as a limiter to the amount of revenue you can recognise?
No, I think it's more about whether you're in the model where you're transferring goods and services at a point of time, or whether it's your overtime model, rather than being a measurement criterion.
Sorry, so I can just assume that one then.
Try again.
Sorry.
No, all right.
Yeah. Okay. If you are constructing a building, if the person is not required to make stage payments but pay on completion, you're not in continuous performance?
No, I mean, it's because I think that's slightly different. What I'm sort of saying is that, yes, you're very likely you've only got an unconditional right to payment at particular specified points in the contract. That's not what we mean. What we mean is sort of saying, you would be contractually obliged to pay for your work done today in the event of sort of frustration of the contract. So it's not a continuous unconditional right to payment. I think it's very similar. It's similar to your idea about saying, subject to your future performance, the customer will be obliged to pay in full for the work to date. And, compare and contrast with the example we talked about earlier with Pat, whereby, yes, you might have to make a payment, but it's designed to compensate the entity for maybe for loss of profit or inconvenience or something like that, but it isn't a payment designed to compensate them for the work that they've done to date.
I think you're treading a very difficult and fine dividing line, which people are going to find hard to understand in terms of what you mean by an entitlement to performance to date, because very few contracts would actually explicitly provide in the contract that should something happen, you pay in full for a half-completed house.
Alberto.
It seems to me that by this conversation, that people reading the same phrases, the same wording, comes to different conclusions on what was meant on by the standard. And if this final standard still is open to such different interpretation, is no good for the constituents. Either you change the wording or you give quite simple but exhaustive illustrative examples. And by the way, I mean, having said this, I think that the right to payment to date is a simple way of measuring whether there is a right to consider, whether there is revenue or not. It's very simple. People would understand quite easily.
Yes, well, I mean, the question of people interpreting things different ways, I mean, it's a good point. But this is a difficult area. The work is going on. We take your comments. I don't think we can at this stage abandon all hope. We're getting very close. Jerome.
Yeah, thank you, Ian. Very briefly, I just wanted to say I agree with what Mike and Alberto just said. I just want to give an additional perspective, especially on this notion that the constituents, continued to be, I don't remember what were the words, unconvinced that there was a need for a standard. There are many, many reasons, but two that I want to flag in the middle of this discussion One that strikes me with the alternative views, but more in general, is that we're trying to define the top line of an income statement in terms of rights. And that is something that, for one, is not obvious. Secondly, is possibly even counterintuitive. Thirdly, is conceptually new. And fourthly, probably dangerous and subject to interpretation, certainly, and many other problems. That's one thing that, when you look at it, I'm sorry, from a distance, is a real cause for concern that I want to convey here very clearly. The second element, to be short, is that listening to our conversation, I wonder if I'm now or 1 year ago, when we had basically the same one, and what I think that gives me the sense of eternity, but I'm not sure that's the best use of resources. So I share that view with you, and that's one of the reasons why the constituents also have this message. It's not only a French one. I know for sure what was said in France, but I understand that was true all over Europe. And when I'm speaking of use of resources, I speak of yours, ours, and theirs. So I really think that at this stage, maybe we should look at the same object from a different angle and wonder what are the priorities. As you see, to me, we're not dealing with priorities here.
Okay, thank you. Wago, did you want to?
No, last time.
Could you push your mic?
During last meetings in the France 1 and others also emphasized this point, and I responded to last time also. I think in your mind still, you know, you like the current basic requirements or criteria for revenue recognition. That is the parallel the conditions. One is the received or receivables, another one is you earned. The difference from the current requirement on the second part, the new proposal emphasized transfer rather than earned. Earned means you process but not transfer. And personally, I accept their concern. And I think it's quite important for both of us to recognize whether receivable or received is one of the basic conditions for revenue recognition, in addition to transfer. And if we agree, then where we should put is another, you know, location problems, as Philippe said. And I will not change, prefer change our position. Transfer notion should be the key to recognize the revenue. But on the other hand, I also accept, you know, right to considerations is another key element, which I think it is a very, very important aspect for auditors. You know, if auditors want to go all this process and right to considerations, I will think it's the other side, they always pay great attention to tests. So let's think about this. I think I agree with the idea there should be parallel conditions, you know, without jeopardizing our key ideas, transfer is the key.
Okay, thank you. Henry.
Which topic do you want to talk about next? I mean, you mentioned that the specific industries, I mean, just to highlight, obviously, I'm sure you're aware of this, but this afternoon, the board are tackling the one that you highlighted, which is obviously the telco, the mobile phone companies, and as you know, that has been an industry that globally, majority of participants in it, you know, have been very critical of the proposals. And so this afternoon we'll be sort of considering whether, you know, there should be any
modifications made to the ED, and we've got two possibilities on the table for the board to consider. One is extending the use of the residual technique, and the other is the telco's preferred solution, which is to introduce a contingent cash cap into the model, and we'll be discussing that this afternoon.
Okay, I guess we would not spend more time on these issues, but just keep in mind that it is in solving the remaining issues for those remaining industries that you really come to a unified principle for revenue recognition. If we move to leases.
Before we do, Ian, can I ask a question on?
Sure. Have you got a microphone?
Yeah, this is. Okay. It's on the re-exposure issue. You'd be aware the staff has put together a paper which we're going to be discussing this week, recommending that we don't re-expose based on our re-exposure criteria. I agree with their analysis, and yet I'm hearing that there's a move push out there for re-exposure. I could interpret your comments, by the way, Jerome, as saying, we've talked about this enough, let's get on, let's get it out there. I don't spend any more time trying to refine things that you're sort of moving into this above 80% territory, and you know, you might improve it marginally and spend a lot of time doing it. But what I'd like to know from you is, do you believe that there's a need for re-exposure based on our normal re-exposure criteria, based on what we've done in responding to constituents' concerns? Because we're going to make that decision.
Yes, there are diverse views on this issue.
Say again?
Among ourselves, there are diverse views on this issue.
Right. And I've heard today that there's some detail that should be looked at. Alberto has said there's so much conflict and people don't understand that we need either a lot more guidance or new words. And Jerome says we have to start from the beginning with a new criteria and build a different standard. So I've heard at least three quite different messages from this group this afternoon. Sorry, John, I'll give you... There you go.
Sorry, I respect... There is a diversity of views. That's absolutely clear. I guess there's a diversity of views around the table. So, and probably behind the screen and everywhere. I would just respond to you, Warren, saying it strikes me that you translate, so to say, my question, which is fair, of course, but into a procedural question. And what I think we should be doing around this table or around another table, I don't mind, but it's to try and think about it in different terms. I mean, you will solve the procedural issue, which is perfectly respectable and necessary and important, but if you know and if we know in our minds what we want. What I was offering was a judgment about where we are, where we stand, and I was saying it very honestly and plainly, regardless of what there is to be done on procedure, which is a different story. Let's not discuss that. I think it's something that that should be a consequence of the strategic view. And strategically speaking, I just offered you a combination of two things which are really factual. The first one is what people say. And, of course, regardless of the fact that they work, because they know they have to work in any case, on standards, but they say exactly what you phrase perfectly, you should probably concentrate on other things, period. That's as simple as that. And secondly, what I offered was, an expression that this has to be taken into consideration, put in perspective, balanced with other priorities, and that, yes, given the scarce resources we all have, you, we, everyone, for dealing with that, maybe we have better things to do. Then we'll deal with the procedural aspects in time. I'm sure we'll find the right solution.
Well, I agree with Francois that we should move on. So is it...
I think it's understandable that people could have diverse views and that it's not easy to know at this point in time whether or not we need to. We have to consider it, but we don't have yet a final staff draft consolidating all the current text. And it's only when you have that element to consider as a package that you can really determine whether this is substantially different from what we have exposed or not, and whether what we have introduced is a result only of our constituents' feedback or some new thinking that has developed. So I can understand that people have diverse views because some people have diverse degrees of understanding of where we are and different levels of knowledge of the final text.
We shouldn't have a debate amongst ourselves, but I do have to pick you up because that isn't the way we address the re-exposure issue. We know the decisions we've made. The staff compile those decisions. We then there is a comparison with what was in the ED. And I don't think we've ever said we need to see the final text, Philip, which is a ballot draft, before we know whether to re-expose or not.
Well, we might have a good debate this afternoon. Lisa?
But very briefly, depending on what you decide this afternoon, you might step on some people's toes and you might tip those people that want something this afternoon. You have to choose. And
whatever we do, somebody... It's we never please everybody in this business.
Sure, but depending on how far you take it one way or the other, you might tip over.
Michael, do you want to have the last say?
I'll be the last one, but just to respond, Warren, I think one of the concerns we would have is that as you move to satisfy legitimate concerns as one constituency, and as we've said, you know, depending which way you go, you may answer set one set of preparers more than another. But at the end of the day, the biggest concern is that the unforeseen consequences of satisfying one constituency, what effect that may have on others. And that's our biggest concern, I suppose. You've got a constituency, the telcos, who are making a lot of noise. You've got a lot of other people out there who are potentially affected, who are making no noise at all, and I think that to some extent...
Michael, we haven't got anybody out there making no noise at all.
we're aware of that.
I assure you.
Comparatively little. So that, I suppose, not quite a view on re-exposure.
That's our normal process, isn't it? You know, we always have some squeaky wheels and some less squeaky wheels.
But I think that to the extent your criteria say, well, have we changed something in response to our constituents' demands, and if we have, that does not indicate re-exposure, I think you have got to bear in mind that in doing that, you have probably raised some concerns with another bunch of constituents who have not had a chance to comment on that proposal.
And where does it end?
And where does it end?